Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this evening is the Salaha Puja, and is the commemoration of the Buddhas. Setting rolling the wheel of Dhamma, or giving the first teaching. And of course that's what we chanted this evening, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And it's a teaching that is interesting on many levels, but like one of the aspects that's interesting is the sense of it being how the Buddha wanted to express his insight into reality, into truth, and what he thought was the most appropriate way to express that insight that led to his liberation. And it's also interesting to remember that on the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha had many, many insights, and the recognition of his past lives, the recognition of the kind of the nature of how causes and conditions set those lives in motion, and all lives, not just his own, but that sense of seeing a principle of how our actions, karma, are what condition the nature of existence, and are the force by which we are drawn into the round of rebirth and make that a repetitive cycle. So that the Buddha had a tremendous range of information that he had had an insight into, or knowledge that arose, but his choice in terms of how to express it so that it would be a benefit for others was the sort of the insight that arose in the in the final watch of the night, was the insight into the ending of the asavas, the ending of the sort of the outflows, the effluents, the fermentations, the I mean, there's all sorts of fascinating words that have been used for the translation of the word asava, and but I think probably a good image to keep in mind is sort of that which flows out to the world and then draws us into that world of becoming and birth, and then of course perpetuating the cycle of rebirth. And the what the Buddha realized was that, of course, it's this internal interaction between ignorance, in the sense of not knowing the true nature of things, and desire, desire, craving, that keeps us trying to seek some sort of, yeah, this sort of seeking and trying to find a point of satisfaction, gratification, contentment, ease somewhere, somehow. And of course, as long as that cycle is being generated by ignorance and desire, then it's impossible to find an end to it. It is truly a hopeless task. It's an endless task. But of course, the Buddha, you say, the insight that the Buddha had, that there was a way out, and that was his exposition of the Four Noble Truths, was an exposition giving the way out, the escape, the opportunity for release from this cycle of on a internal psychological realm of dissatisfaction, discontent, suffering, and on a larger scale, and on a larger scale in terms of the world, and a larger scale in terms of time, this cycle of rebirth, going through existence after existence, and in different realms, so that the Buddha's insight into the Four Noble Truths and his desire to teach that was this is coming from the mind of complete clarity and confidence after having experienced the kind of relief of liberation, being able to set down the cycle of rebirth, set down the cycle of suffering, and being motivated to to help, to assist, to be like give the opportunity to others out of compassion, so that the you know, there's a sense in many parts of the Buddhist world, and you know, whether it's in other schools or whether it's in Theravada as well, you know, that kind of Four Noble Truths is just kind of the basic stuff, and there's all sorts of other interesting things or much more philosophically interesting or philosophically astute. But I think it misses the point that this is how the enlightened mind of a Buddha saw the most effective way of expressing the way out, the way of liberation. And on a certain level, the various themes and teachings that the Buddha gave over his lifetime of 45 years are kind of a variation on a theme of these Four Noble Truths, or maybe an extrapolation coming from these Four Noble Truths, say like the whole expression of dependent origination is kind of a filling out or a elucidation, but the Four Noble Truths in a more complex way. But the purpose of it is to illustrate those Four Noble Truths, and that the principle of the Four Noble Truths is the core, the heart, insight that was the, you know, the basis for the Buddha's liberation. So for ourselves, I think it's an important teaching to be returning to again and again, to review, to reflect on, to tease out the various implications and permutations of those Four Noble Truths, and you know, particularly this being the beginning of the or tomorrow being the beginning of the rains retreat, that you know we all take the time to really direct our attention to those Four Noble Truths and see, well, what more can I learn from them? Because they, you know, the problem in terms of our practice oftentimes is not that we don't know the information or have the fact, you know, sort of various Buddhist factoids at our disposal, but we don't apply them, we don't reflect on them deeply, we don't consider them in from different angles, so that we really allow it to allow those the teachings to really penetrate the heart. And this teaching on the Four Noble Truths of really seeing dukkha, seeing the that which is suffering, subject to dissatisfaction, that which is imperfect, that which is fraught with discontent, to recognize, you know, how truly pervasive that is. And the Buddha goes through it, you know, birth is suffering, aging suffering, death is suffering. These are all fairly, you know, just the common circumstances of having having a body, having a limited lifespan. These are all things that nobody looks forward to. But also on an internal level of the sense of, you know, having to be associated with the disliked, that is dukkha. Being separated from the light, the loved, is dukkha. Not getting what one wants, is dukkha. And then the Buddha, sort of in brief, say the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha, the upadana khanda, these khandas, these five aggregates of being that are enmeshed in upadana, grasping, clinging. So that whenever we have these khandas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness, aligned and subject to clinging, it's always going to be a source of suffering, frustration, dissatisfaction in some way, shape, or form. It's just as is. That's what nature is. And that's, you know, a lot of it is because we, of the identification and assumption of this is what I am. I am my body. I am my feelings. I am the perceptions, memories. This is who I. That's what I associate with. Thoughts. You know, whether it's an intelligent thought or a completely dumb thought or a fleeting thought or a persistent thought. This is what we identify. This is who I am. I am this thought. Or is this thought just myself? This is what the feeling is. And of course that's exactly what is the Buddha is saying. This is ignorance, avijja and tanha, desire and delusion, functioning together to perpetuate that identification, association, consciousness. The same thing as we have conscious experience of something, and we don't just recognize it as an impermanent phenomenon that is dependent on sense contact and the sort of the external object of the physical sense, the eye, and the ability of the mind to be conscious of it is just a we experience it as, you know, this is either me or mine, or what I am, and that that in itself, that constructing of a of an identification, association of selfhood, is in itself the source of suffering. So that when we have that sense of an internal sense of self, then we construct a world outside which we're either trying to draw into our sphere of our desire so that it can be pleasant and gratifying or satisfying in some way, or we are in opposition to it, averse to it, irritated by it, afraid of it, and we live with that dichotomy, that kind of split, which is, it's impossible to. This is why the Buddha said this sense of this is dukkha, the whole. These five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. And, of course, our experience is filtered through that. Now, the whole purpose of the teaching is not just to become depressed about this and throw up one's hands in frustration and say, well, what's the point anyway? I mean, the point is that there is a way out, and that's the refrain that the Buddha gives throughout the suttas. You know, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And so that to be able to recognize that the teachings are there for freeing oneself from suffering, seeing through the habitual tendency, seeing through the sort of the cloud of kind of confiscation, where there was everything's being obscured by ignorance and desire, and being able to pull back from that, to step back from that, to not identify with that, to release, to relinquish that, and recognize that, wow, when we are able to really let go of that, there's a whole different experience. Probably the simplest expression, and you know, very direct expression of the Four Noble Truths, is by Lupu Dun, and he switches the order around a little bit because he's putting it into a cause and effect series, in the sense that the mind that goes outside of itself is the cause of suffering, and the result of the mind going outside of itself is suffering. So that when the mind goes out, looking for an object, and that object isn't just sort of outside in terms of looking at the trees and the flowers and the realms of thing outside, but it's going out of its base of peace, out of its base of purity, out of its base of stillness. And then the mind, seeing the mind, is the path leading out of suffering, the path to the cessation of suffering. And the result of the mind, seeing the mind, is cessation, is nibbana, is nirodha, is the end of suffering. Directing our attention, or allowing our attention to not be distracted and diverted away from that fundamental stillness and clarity, fundamental peace and stability within, not diverting it, not losing it, not so that tapping into that, returning to that base. It's not creating that base, but returning to it, so that the path is one of course, there's many skillful means to support that, but it's important to recognize the heart of it. Otherwise, one spends one's time just constantly trying to perfect a methodology, perfecting a technique. The techniques are necessary, they're essential. We need to be skilled in learning the tools of practice. But you also have to understand what they're for. And it's like the Zen story of the six patriarchs, and just that polishing polishing the mirror is not the goal of the exercise. It's not just really seeing that they're really there is no mirror, there is no beings that are appearing in it. We create the stories. We love the stories about me and mine, the story of I am is so compelling. And whether it's I am happy or I am suffering, I am good, I am bad, I am worthy, I am unworthy. All of them are stories. And of course, once we get in, we get entranced by the sort of story of I and me and mine, and of course it's the whole world of others are all there. And we end up either, depending on our propensities, we either end up being irritated and averse to it because of dosa jarit, our temperament of aversion. So then we see the world as something that is, see the world, see ourselves as something that's irritating, worthy of aversion, frustrating. Or we, there's the lakacharit, the temperament of desire. We see it as desirable, attractive, fascinating, an object of our wanting. Or we're confused by it. Mohajivit, we're sort of confused and dumbfounded by it all, whether it's ourselves or the world around us. So that these basic sort of temperaments are sort of condition, it's the internal conditioning, our experience of the world around us. And you say, well, this is all suffering. It's unsatisfying. But it's always essential to be returning to these Four Noble Truths as being, recognizing that, that it isn't just this unmitigated causes of suffering resulting in suffering all the time, but that there, there is a way out, there is an escape, there is an opportunity for cessation. But it also takes we have to, in the same way that there's the causes for suffering, there's the causes for experiencing the end of suffering. There's causes that we need to put into place, and they need to be attended to. Of course, the Eightfold Path is the classical structure of that, and it's that sort of the way of practice, the way of training, recognizing that there is a path of training that is sila, samadhi, panya, the virtue, restraint, integrity. Those are all a necessary means for cultivating the training of our body and speech, the aspects of samadhi, of tranquility, clarity, calmness, stability of heart. Those are all accomplished through the basis of effort and mindfulness, and then focus, and the path of sort of discernment, wisdom, seeing things in their true nature. But that path also has to have a focus as well. And that path of training, the path of practice, has to have a focus or an ethos or a tone to it. And that's what the Buddha expresses in the Third Noble Truth, when we chant the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and pointing to the underlying sort of tone or flavor of what is it that's going to lead to suffering, or the qualities of heart that need to be attended to. Chako, patinisago, mutti, analio. Those are the qualities, the flavor of approach that is how we cultivate the path in order for it to result in the cessation of suffering. Chako, which is giving. Chaka is a, again the anusati, the recollections. The first one is chaka anusati, the reflections on generosity, on giving. And chaka has the tone or the implication of, like, dana is usually the word that is used for giving or generosity. And chaka is very similar in its meaning, but it also has an implication of both giving as well as giving away, giving up. So that there's that sense of chaka is, you know, of a generosity, but also a giving and giving up. That is a underlying basis of the application of the tools of the path. Patinisago is a relinquishment. A relinquishment, letting go. That's Ajahn Chah would emphasize that in terms of the, you know, the heart of the path is sort of knowing and letting go, knowing and letting go. You know, sort of a rule, like a boy wang, rule, like a boy wang. So that knowing and letting go, knowing and relinquishment. So patinisago is the letting go. And letting go, relinquishment, and oftentimes that relinquishment is, when it's expressed or explained, is not just the relinquishment of of goods, of material things, or even of moods and feelings and defilements, but a letting go of the sense of self. A letting go of the kind of the glue that holds the clinging together, so that relinquishment of the I identification, and of course it's the on it. On a practice level, then you have to. The way to do that is the relinquishment of the expressions of that sense of I. So the desires, the moods, the feelings, the views, the opinions. Those are kind of the expressions, the tail end of the infatuation with the I. But you, to get to the root of it, you need to practice that relinquishment on those expressions, on those the manifestations of the eye delusion. So it's that letting go is relinquishment, letting go, and the heart really needs to kind of leap forward at that and see. Recognize the opportunity that one has of fulfilling the path by being willing to relinquish, to let go. You know, we're usually so hopelessly enmeshed in our moods and and identifications with our own suffering or our righteousness or our hopes of gratification, that we even to try to conceive of relinquishment just doesn't even flicker through the mind. And then we wonder why we suffer. To really bring to mind if we really want to experience a cessation of suffering, that quality of patinisago, relinquishment, has to be there. We have to be willing to let go. Mutti, say the freedom. And to, in the way that it's used, it's not just as some static state of freedom, but actually being able to rely on a state of freedom. Our attention goes to entanglement, or our attention goes to where the problem is. Our attention goes to the things that irritate or excite us. Why don't we allow our attention to go to what is free, is unentangled, is peaceful? What's the fascination with the things that just keep sort of aggravating and frustrating us? What's the point of it? And of course, the point is we've got avijja and tanha. And we're that's all we can see through. But the opportunity that we have is being taking on the Buddhist teaching is that we can take a point of freedom. We can take we can actually realize. I mean, that's the Buddha's teaching of these Four Noble Truths in Dhammacakka Sutta. I mean, that's the section on the cessation of suffering, on Nirodha. Nirodha is to be realized. Sacikkhātabhati. And then it has been realized. Sacikkhātanti. This cessation of suffering has been realized. This is a possibility. And if we choose to keep circling and cycling and flitting around suffering, and then we're making that choice, or we're just following it blindly. Like moths flying into the flame. go, what's the point of these moths constantly flying into the flames and burning themselves up all the time? Don't they ever learn? So that quality of mutti, of relying on the quality of freedom, to turn your attention to the quality of freedom. Anālayo is sort of non-complication or non-stickiness or probably non-stickiness is probably the best, because that's because even when we recognize something as suffering, there's still that sort of fascination with it, and we end up, just wanting to try a little bit, and then of course we get stuck. Whether it's desire or aversion or delusion. I mean, there's a certain element of, especially as we continue to investigate and watch, and there's, we're sort of bent on sort of seeing how much we can sort of get away with. And we get, it's sticky. And you end up back in the cycle again. Sort of we're willing to entertain sort of thoughts and feelings of just a little bit more, or just a little bit, I won't get stuck this time, or this aversion or irritation comes up, and there's a part of us that sort of shrinks back, and then there's another part that says, oh, well, it really shouldn't be that way. It really shouldn't. It's really worthy of getting righteous. It's really worthy of getting, it really needs to be told. I have to straighten them out. And then, of course, you're stuck. You start spinning around and aversion and irritation. So that anālayo is just non-sticking, that's not getting stuck in, and not getting entangled, not getting drawn in to the pull of the defilements, of the kilesas, of the attachments. And of course, when there's that non-sticking, it's just how spacious the mind can be. somebody, you know, there's, you know, the worldly dhammas come, as they constantly do, and it's just as they, okay, praise doesn't stick, blame doesn't stick, pleasure doesn't stick, pain doesn't stick, gain, it doesn't, nothing, it doesn't, mind doesn't move, loss, it doesn't stick in there. One has one's base of clarity and stillness and peace, and why would one want to give that up for the movement, vacillation, agitation of the worldly dhammas? So, of course, we do all the time, but that's the opportunity is one of not letting it stick to the mind, just letting it isn't as if one doesn't know it or see it or experience it, but it doesn't stick. And when it doesn't stick, it doesn't shake the mind. The mind is unshakable. And that's the possibility we have. You know, we can live with this quality of unshakable stillness, unshakable clarity, unshakable peace. You know, it isn't as if the world isn't there as it always has been, but it's experienced from a place of chako patinisago mutti anabhyo. And those are, it's a place of this is our refuge. So that this teaching that the Buddha gave 2,500 years ago, it's learning how to use it, apply it, explore it, test it, question it, challenge it, but become skilled in really allowing it to work on the heart, and seeing these Four Noble Truths are the expression of the Buddha's full and complete enlightenment. And that as we really apply it and work with it, you know, we have the opportunity for participating in that same enlightenment, that same liberation. You know, that's a tremendous gift that the Buddha gave to the world. You know, we have tremendous good fortune to be able to be a recipient of that, you know, to whatever extent we're willing to take it on. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.